This podcast is brought to you by Learn Prime. Start your journey to becoming a great developer at learn.thoughtbot.com.
Shut the fuck up, Google. Technology sucks. Hey, everybody. This is Gordon in Boston.
And this is Mark in San Francisco.
And this is Rita in Stockholm.
And this is Build Phase. So Rita's here.
Hello. my name is Rita Lemedin. I am a designer, front-end developer, a Thoughtbot. And I'm currently in the Stockholm office. Yeah, I think that should do it. For now, at least.
How about that Nocta unlock? What do we think of that?
It hasn't worked for me since it worked flawlessly 3 days ago. Mm. It worked perfectly 3 days ago, one time, and since then it hasn't reconnected to my phone.
Ah.
Yeah, I haven't tried it out. I still can't believe it would work, and even if it would, I don't think it's going to be that much of an improvement over the experience. I just have a very short password, or no password at all.
I think it works really well when it does work. You know, like when it did work for me, it was super fast and a lot easier to get in than typing my password. I do have a longer password, but then it's not even the app's fault. It's Bluetooth. That Bluetooth low energy stuff just sucks. The radios aren't spinning up or something isn't happening, so it just never connects to my phone.
How do you think they're adding the animation to the login window? I didn't even know that you could access that.
Yeah, right.
I don't think you can, actually. They're doing an overlay. They're just doing an overlay. They're doing some kind of view hierarchy hacking.
Well, it's impressive.
Scary.
It's impressive.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, that was the intriguing part, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super impressive and also kind of terrifying. They essentially added a keylogger to your login screen.
Right. I was just going to say, it's this thing that's just sitting around and knows your password and just punches it in for you. Creepy.
Secure.
I was thinking they were using some sort of private APIs. Isn't that, if they're in the App Store, I guess that's not going to be the case, right?
They're not, though.
They're not in the App Store, but also they're just pasting your password in. Like, you give them your password and then they just paste the password in and hit enter when you knock.
That can't be very secure though, right? Because they're either storing it in plain text or they're just encrypting it and then decrypting it when it's time to put it in.
The whole thing. I mean, everything about it is like kind of sketchy, like super awesome as like a tech demo, right? It's really an impressive tech demo, but you start thinking about the implementation and it gets real creepy real quick.
I just quit it. I just quit Nocta Unlock. You guys talked me into it.
Yeah, I should turn it off. So I think what we wanted to talk about today was talking about UI development. You do design, but you taught yourself Objective-C and some...
Right.
Core graphic kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. So I started design with Photoshop, but I'll spare you the details because that's exactly how every design story starts. And I moved to web design around 2008-09. And in 2010, I was working for a big company who were actually starting to have iPhone or mobile projects, both iPhone and Android. That's in 2010. That would be iOS 3 / 4. And I was working on a social network. Yeah, this sounds a little bit of a cliche, but that's actually was the case. I was doing the design part of the project, and we were actually hiring external developers to implement those designs. So it would be the typical workflow where I would send a bunch of PSDs or pings to the developer, and he would implement them and send us a build. I don't think we were using test flight or anything of that kind back then. I'm not even sure if test flight was around. But we were, yeah, he would send us a build, and we would test that, and I would notice, like, a bunch of things that I'm not happy with, and I would fix them on Photoshop, email them, wait for him to... it was remote also, so, like, I would wait for him to show up on the chat and then, you know, ask him that this thing, like tell him what to fix, like, you know... And over time, I just was curious of, like, if I can make this a little bit easier for everyone. So I started learning Objective-C. So I got a bunch of books, and I was really excited. And as soon as I started, I just figured out that it wasn't that easy. So I come from a web background, and where everything is like HTML and CSS, and those are really have a very low barrier to entry, and they're quite simple in the way they work. So I was kind of like underestimating what I'm getting into in the beginning. Like I can probably pick some things, but it was really hard just at the point where I had to. So, like, any book I would pick up, the first thing that I would start learning about is, like, memory. And for me, like, I didn't know that there was something like that's called memory that I have to worry about, just because we designed for browsers and we don't care about those kind of things. And right. I was like, yeah, okay, memory, so what's the deal? And Arc was just being introduced at that point, so a lot of the stuff was still manual memory management, ALEC, dealloc, and that stuff is absolutely confusing to someone who doesn't have a good computer science background. And that was my case, technically. So, yeah, I gave up. I was in a couple of like workshops, iOS workshops, but they were mostly like how to submit your app to the App Store and how to do stuff like, you know, not actual implementation. So I gave up, and I always was like trying to get into iOS, but I always hit that wall. So, and I would probably just back off and come back to it a couple of months later, same problem. In 2011, I started watching the iTunes U course. That was the Stanford course by Paul Hegarty. And that one actually helped me figure out some of the things that I couldn't figure out in the beginning. So things like memory management and, yeah, classes or stuff like that, like objective programming. I didn't finish the course, but at least it got me to a point where I was comfortable enough to just go around and pick chapters from other books and just continue learning. And, yeah, I think that's how I got started with iOS. It's until last year that I started actually getting really into the details of implementing designs and working with front-end stuff on iOS. Today, I really like doing that, and I'm still learning a bunch of stuff. It's just like there's so much stuff to learn.
We'll just, I guess, get into it. How much do you guys use nibs or storyboards when you're prototyping or when you're actually doing the production?
Mark?
All the time. For... Yeah. Everything. Yeah. Storyboards where I can. I've learned on this latest project that storyboards can quickly grow out of hand, and we have this one massive storyboard, and on Xcode 5 it takes about 15 seconds to load it. It's obnoxious. I've been working on splitting that up, and any new view controllers I've been putting into their own storyboards. So I'm using my own storyboard for anything that's linked up. Like if it has segues drawn between it, like everything I can grab together goes in its own storyboard. And then just for views, I use nibs and then have a category on UI view that gets the nib and unarchives the object.
This afternoon, actually, I was talking to Jack, one of our other iOS developers, about the storyboard love-hate cycle. And that's basically, you discover that, like, you learn about storyboards and you're like, holy shit, this stuff is awesome. And then you really overuse them to a point where they just don't work anymore. And then you go back to do it, to win everything in code. And then over time, you realize, well, actually, I can delegate some of this stuff to storyboards. So you go back to that, like, middle ground where you use them for, like, big picture stuff. But you try to not, like, use them for everything that's UI related. And I think that's a good position to be in.
I've been using them to try to understand auto layout better before I try to understand how to write constraints in code. And the auto layout editor in Xcode 5 is really good.
Yeah.
It makes much more sense than the one in 4.0.
Yeah, the Xcode 5 fixed almost all of my problems with auto layout, I feel like. I've been working on like a Mac app for the past, like just a mock up of a Mac app, so just the prototype stage. And for like the past week I've been working on it, and I've been kind of using it as an excuse to wrap my head around auto layout, especially since on the Mac it feels more important to use that kind of stuff, because seemingly simple stuff, right? Like I have a window and there's a label in the window, and when I resize the window I want the label to wrap and I want everything to get pushed down with it. And using auto layout for that made a lot more sense than trying to do some like frame math.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the reasons why I use nibs, is because I'm so much more likely to add a layout bug when I'm writing code than Interface Builder is.
Yeah, I think what you just said, Gordon, is absolutely right. I mean, it's a no-brainer to make a Mac app without using auto layout. And in fact, I would say that I was just saying this a while ago, is that like iOS apps that require like complex layout algorithms are probably doing something wrong, because an iOS app should be quite simple to begin with. Like, I mean, there are some simple things that you really need to do with auto layout, but like if you have a bunch of views that have to have some certain layout, probably you need to step back and rethink some of the ways your higher, like the controllers and the views are set up in the first place.
When you're building a complex view, do you typically use subview hierarchies, or do you try to do a lot of drawing in code?
I'll use subview hierarchies now. On iOS 4, I think, Lauren Brichter, a long time ago, during the Tweety 2 days, wrote a blog post on how he got 60 frames per second scrolling in Tweety 2, and the way he got 60 frames per second scrolling in Tweety 2, even on, you know, the 3GS, was that he used no frame hierarchies or no subview hierarchies and just drew everything into the cell as a flat view, right? Like he just drew there weren't any labels in Tweety 2. It was literally drawing strings onto the screen or into a view, and then that view became the cell. So I used that, but I probably wouldn't go back to that unless I had some crazy performance reason to do it. But most of the devices at this point are good enough to not have to worry about that as much as we used to. I'm trying to think of when I would draw something in code versus... I guess we did some like progress bar animations, like a circular progress indicator thing. So, you know, I think we had to draw that stuff in code. But even that was essentially just taking two images and drawing the status, drawing them onto the screen in a specific way. You know what I mean?
Right. So you're basically like, are those like images that you generate in code, or is it something that you have in your assets?
Yeah, they were actual image assets.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I totally get that.
And then you're just animating a mask, or
essentially, yeah.
I see.
Yeah, I don't remember the exactly what we were doing, but yeah, it was basically animating a mask.
So the thing that I've been trying to get into is like, drawing the assets in code and then saving them, caching them in a way that you can reuse them in that session. And I think I really like this approach because it gives you the power of like using code to draw, so like you can change like things really easy. And also it doesn't have as much of a performance cost as like saying, like say drawing every time the view shows up. So yeah, that's something I've been doing. And well, it has, so the only implication is that if you have a lot of assets, you have to monitor your cache. But so far, it never happened to me. Like most of the apps, they would have a few icons or a few backgrounds here and there. So I've never had this issue of like, yeah, you might need to keep an eye on the app cache, like disk cache. But that never happened to me so far. And I really like this approach.
Are you talking specifically about the UI image cache? The one that gets invoked by using image named?
Yes, but like also storing the bitmap data in a variable or reusing it in a property.
Got it.
So like basically drawing images in code, but just like lazily initializing them. So you draw it once and then you hold on to it and use it everywhere you need to hold on to it.
Yeah.
Oh, I did some core animation this week and it was an exercise in frustration. I don't understand core animation as well as I thought I did.
Core frustration. I saw that.
Yeah. Right. I was just trying to do a simple animation where this thing would spin, it would pop in using a keyframe animation and then shrink out when it's done. And things would happen where it would pop in, but then it wouldn't rotate. Or it would rotate and it would just appear on screen and then disappear. I just don't understand core animation. And I really didn't want to use like affine transforms on the view. I thought it'd be better to use the layer. Also, did you know that animations are removed from layers when you go into the background? So when you come back to the foreground, you have to manually add your animations back? Why? That seems...
I have no idea. I didn't know dumb. That, in fact.
So like animations that are in progress or...
Just so if you add an animation to a layer and you set removed on completion to no... So it sticks on the layer for as long as the layer is around. And you go to the background, it seems to get removed.
Oh.
So in my case, you hit like the Facebook button, and I show this spinner. And if you don't have the Facebook credentials in the app, we kick you out to Safari, and you off, and you come back. And when you come back, the spinner is just stopped dead. Annoying. I'd love to know why that is.
That's sweet.
Thus, core frustration.
So how do you get around that? Do you have to save... a reference to that animation and then re-add it on will become...
Yeah, you have to listen to the notification, save off the animation, and then re-add all your animations to the layer. I guess you could have one like animation setup method that just gets called when you're ready for it and when you come back from the background, but
yeah,
it's still an odd quirk.
Yeah, I haven't spent as much time as I would like with core animation. Like I've done basic stuff here and there, but like I would like to get into it sometime. But now actually you're discouraging me.
No. Mark. It's super awesome when it finally works right.
Yeah. So I talked to David Runkvist. I'm pretty sure I'm not pronouncing his name right because it has one of those Swedish letters in it. He's the guy who writes a lot about core animation and basically, yeah, core animation or core graphics. And I was talking to him during the last CocoaHeads, and he showed us some really neat tricks as far as like timing animations and things like that. And I just felt like I really have some catching up to do when it comes to core animation. Did any of you have time to play with UI dynamics?
I've just been toying around. I tried to recreate the lock screen on iOS 7, where you can grab the camera and like lift it up and let it fall with gravity, or you can propel it down using the velocity from a pan gesture. But nothing that's in production code or part of a real app.
Because my thinking was like, if you use UI dynamics, you won't be doing a lot of the manual animation stuff that you do in core animation. So it's sort of like it became less critical It still is, but I think now you have one extra layer of abstraction that you can use to get really neat animation effects without actually getting into the nitty-gritty details of like timing them and things like that.
It almost feels like auto layout does to like frame math, right? Like instead of doing the frame math, I just kind of declare a layout, and instead of having to set up all the math for a animation, I just kind of declare some physical properties to the thing and then let it do that. It's a more declarative way of approaching that same thing. Like you had, Rita, you had done a bounce animation in an app for like you swipe a cell and the cell pops over, and then when it comes back it hits the left side and it bounces a little bit. And that was all done through like math and timing and stuff. And I feel like you could have gotten rid of all that code and just added some dynamics to it. Added gravity, added some mass.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the current Learn iOS app, I spent a lot of time timing the bounce animation. It's like it's really hard to get right because it needs to feel natural, but also like it needs to have the right... Well, actually, yeah, it needs to have the right ease in and all of those things. And doing those things manually is not always easy. So if you just miss it 1 second, it would feel a little bit inconsistent. Like the first bounce is not as... doesn't have the same velocity as the second one. So those kind of things are the things that like UI Dynamics is totally taken care of. So you don't have to worry about the details. And just as you said, you describe what you want or how it should be done. Or no, actually you describe what you want and the system takes care of making that happen. So I think it's a step in the right direction. And I don't think that any other framework out there has something like this. Well, so obviously there are like all the game libraries and those have that kind of stuff, but like for app design, I think Apple is doing something really good here.
Yeah, adding physics as just like a platform feature, like
yeah,
like you know, you're building a checklist, physics engine is on there for iOS now. It's just like a thing that's available.
How do you think that came about? Do you think it was they wanted to build their own game physics engine, and then they got to a point and they said, hey, we could use this to underpin like a higher level in UIKit? Or was it, we want to add physics to UIKit, let's build this library that does physics, and then they go, hey, we could make this public for game purposes?
I kind of feel like it would be something that would come out of SceneKit, right? Like that they were like 2D games... and these kind of like simple casual games are something that, I mean, it's a big part of Apple's ecosystem, app ecosystem at this point, right? And so empowering those developers to some extent is in line with what they're trying to do. So building SceneKit. So yeah, I could see them building SceneKit, and then I keep saying SceneKit, I mean SpriteKit. building SpriteKit and then being like, oh, hey, there's a totally extractable physics engine here that we could just plug into UIKit. That makes more sense to me than them being like, we want UIKit to be bouncy, and then being like, oh, crap, we totally built a game engine.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the case. It just feels like they were putting a lot of effort behind games, like the controller stuff and the sprite kit. And I guess at some point they just decided to extract that and make it part of UIKit, just because they realized that it's really good. And in fact, a lot of game libraries, they have some really nice APIs that I would actually want to use in apps. So yeah, animation is one of them. And there's also like SceneKit, but I have yet to see it like used for something, for something that actually I use on an everyday basis.
I wonder if this sudden focus on gaming has something to do with Apple's plans for the Apple TV. I mean, they probably see that any sort of TV platform is going to involve gaming, right? And that's going to be the biggest appeal. And I think I read somewhere that SpriteKit is really just Box 2D expanded. Apple bought Box 2D. And there are even some references to it, but who knows how much they've modified it. for their purposes.
The thing is, like, talking about SyncKit, it doesn't feel like it would have some real, like, some good use or some obvious use for Mac apps. It just feels like it. You need to think really hard. So I've heard that the Reveal app is using SyncKit for the view thing. Like, you know, so Reveal app, for those of you who haven't heard about it, is like an app that helps you inspect the view hierarchy of your iOS apps, and they're using SyncKit to render those view hierarchies.
That's cool. I didn't realize they were using SyncKit for that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either, but I heard from someone who knows a lot about SyncKit, who happens to be the developer I mentioned earlier.
So, do you ever do view introspection stuff, like using Reveal or Spark Inspector or Pony Debugger or any of that stuff?
I use Pony Debugger, actually. But it's actually fairly rare that I use it for the view debugging. Mm. I mainly use it to watch requests going out and responses coming back.
Right. See, I just use I end up using Charles for that kind of stuff, so I don't.
Yeah, I haven't had the chance to use Reveal yet, but the thing is, like, I also can't think of a good use case for now, because, well, probably later on when I build an app with a really complex view hierarchy and I would like to know what's going on. But other than that, I really know the apps I'm working on, like the back of my hand. So I don't really need to know, like, how, because if I need an inspector tool to know the hierarchy of my views, it's probably a sign that I'm doing something wrong. But that's the way I feel about it. I haven't tried it yet. Maybe there would be a real good use case for that I haven't thought of. But yeah, so far I haven't had that urge to use it.
So I have in my LLDB init, I have a command RD that just does, I mentioned this in an earlier podcast, but it just does a recursive description of every element on the screen. So it just prints it out in the debugger. So I just get this, the few times I have been like, oh, I need to, why isn't this thing tappable? Or, you know, why isn't this label showing up? You know, maybe there's some logic around the label and it should be showing up and I can see that it's showing up, but it's not showing up, you know. I can do, you know, I'll just type RD into LLDB and it'll just print out the recursive description. But there was a blog post that came out like a couple days ago about how, so one of the things that has kept me away from using stuff like Reveal or Spark Inspector or Pony Debugger is having to add those frameworks to my project to use them. It just, I mean, it's not a huge deal. Like, there's a CocoaPod for Reveal, for example, and I'm sure that there's one for Spark Inspector, and I know that there's one for Pony Debugger too, right, Mark?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's always, so it's not a huge deal, but it's always been just kind of like one thing that's kept me from using them. But so Reveal, they did a blog post about how you don't actually need to do that. You can use LLDB to inject Reveal, the library, into your app, at least in the simulator. You can use it to inject the library into your app during runtime. And so I added, they had these commands laid out, right, for like aliases, basically LLDB aliases, so that you can just hit pause anywhere and then write, you know, type Reveal underscore load, and it'll load Reveal into your app, and then you can start up Reveal. And the thing that they really kind of, that really kind of caught my eye about it is they had an idea for using breakpoints to do that. So you have like a Reveal load command and you set a breakpoint somewhere and have it run Reveal load. I run my app, it breaks where the problem is, and then also pulls up, it could also inject Reveal, pull it up for me. And then I can expect it from there. That actually kind of makes more sense to me than just always having this library pulled into my app. Like, I almost bought Reveal yesterday specifically because of this blog post. And I was like, oh, that actually sounds useful to me. Because that's how I use the recursive description stuff, right? It's like,
yeah.
Every now and then I'm like, oh, God, where the hell is this thing? Like, it doesn't happen every day. It doesn't happen every week. But when it does happen, it would be nice to have a visual representation as opposed to just this kind of textual thing that I have to dig through.
I've found that I only use recursive description for nefarious purposes, and it's usually to see inside of Apple's views because I want to do some view spelunking or something. The most recent case of that was I have cells in this app that have buttons in them, and I don't want the tap on them to be delayed. And so previously you could just set delays content touches to no on the table view or scroll view. But because cells now have a scroll view inside of them, you have to set it on that one too. And there's no interface for it on UI table view cell. So you have to dig through the subviews, find the scroll view, turn off delays content touches, and then everything works. But yeah, the only time I find myself using that is to do bad things like that. So are you actually using Reveal, Gordon?
No, I haven't. I'm serious. No, not on the Mac app. This was all the Mac app was just like literally just dummy data punched into labels. You know, I tried to do as little code as possible, but I am thinking about using it for my next project. Whenever I get, you know, the next project I'm on, I'm seriously thinking about using it just as an experiment. To see how it feels, see how useful it is, see how often I end up using it.
Yeah, I was definitely intrigued by the concept, but I remember when I tried to use it the first time, they didn't even have a CocoaPod. So you had to do it like manually, add it to the project and all of that. And that was like a deal breaker for me.
I love that we're at the point where if something doesn't have a pod, we just won't use it.
Absolutely.
It makes me so happy.
We came a long way, right?
Well, there was that really great, really awesome, it was like a quick look plugin for LLDB. And so what you had to do was you added some commands to your LLDB init, like a quick look, basically a quick look command you added to your LLDB init, and then you would also have to add these category methods to NSObject, basically, that adds Xcode 5's quick look stuff. So, like, if you hover your mouse over a thing and you can click on, you know, here's a variable, here's a UI image, for example, right? And I can hover my mouse over it and it gets a little pop-up and then I click the eyeball and then I can quick look that image from within Xcode, which is an awesome feature, but I don't touch my mouse. You know, I rarely ever touch my mouse. And so what this allows you to do is type, you know, QL, you know, my image into LLDB, and then it will open up that image in Quick Look, which is pretty awesome. But you needed to add these category methods to NSObject inside your project. And so, like, this came out on, you know, I found it because of iOS Dev Weekly like a few weeks ago, and the first thing I did was I just wrote a CocoaPod for it. I was like, hey, here. Like, I just wrote the pod spec and I opened up a pull request. I was like, here you go. This works. Go ahead and submit it to the repo.
Thoughtbot should start a nonprofit where we just create pods for libraries that don't have them.
I know.
Yeah. We'll call it Pod Friday.
Changing the world one pod spec at a time.
Yeah.
Send us money.
I've done it for a couple of GitHub owned repos too. Which is kind of fun because I think that they're not super secretly annoyed by it.
We should find libraries by people who are like vehemently anti pod. And then just bombard them with pull requests to add this pod spec.
I don't think
they get that
anyway.
last week, Justin at Justin on Twitter, whose last name I'm blanking on for whatever.
Is that Justin Bieber?
Yep, yeah. Justin Bieber. Just last week, Justin Bieber was complaining about people opening up CocoaPod's pull requests against one of his libraries. Whatever. I don't want to get into all that, but I think it would be funny to just, like, first of all, pod specs aren't that hard to write. They really aren't. If they're hard to write, then you're doing something wrong in your library, almost without a doubt. You know what I mean? Like, if you, I've written maybe a dozen pod specs at this point, maybe more. I've never touched like the post-install and pre-install hook stuff. You know, most of the time, I think 99% of the time, I don't know, that's a made-up statistic, but a damn good chunk of the time, it should be pointing it at source files, right? Like, here's the source files, you know, go.
Yeah.
And that's as easy as the pod spec is. I feel like people that are opening up pull requests asking, or opening up issues asking for CocoaPods should just try writing one of them themselves. They're not difficult to write. It's not like you actually need to know Ruby. It's not like you actually need to know anything. Just figure out what frameworks they're linking against, declare those, point to the source files. It takes like 5 minutes, and then we don't have people bitching and moaning about stuff like this on Twitter.
Is updating the specs still like PR based? Because I was thinking at some point they were trying to figure out a way to make things a lot more streamlined. How's the status on that, as far as you know?
Yeah, right. So right now, yeah, they used to give everybody push access once you open a pod. So like I have push access, and I know Mark has push access too, but they closed that a while back because there were just too many people and people were screwing up the pod's repository. So now they shut it down and it's all pull request based, which sucks, but I don't know where they are on it, but I know that what they were working on was like a thin wrapper on top of GitHub. So the whole thing would still be based on GitHub, but there would be a wrapper on top that you would be able to authenticate against and just push your pod to that. And then like a robot basically would be able to deal with pulling it into the repo itself. You know, I know that they're working on making that better, but.
So what's your guys' opinion on the transition to iOS 7 style UIs? How are third-party apps faring? How are Apple's App Store apps making the transition? What do we like and dislike?
I don't think most people are doing it. I just really don't. I really think that still most apps on the store right now, at least most of the apps on my phone that I use constantly, are really just iOS 6 apps with iOS 7 navbars. I don't feel like they're doing anything interesting. You know, I mean, I think that they're great apps. Like Twitterific, I think, looks great, works great. Tweetbot, I'm not super in love with the style that Tweetbot chose for iOS 7. I think it's a shame that they toned it down that much. I think that they could have done some stuff with the status bar and nav bar kind of stuff. I think they could have done more than they did. But all the animation stuff looks and feels great. I just don't think that it's that, I don't know, that kind of thing wasn't the interesting thing to me in iOS 7. It was I still think that the most interesting thing in iOS 7 is the concept of context, keeping context inside of an app, not leaving one screen to go to another screen, instead just kind of transitioning in place in between those two screens. I think people are missing that for the most part.
Yeah, I think I share a lot of your thoughts regarding iOS 7. But the way I see it is that at this stage, a lot of developers and designers are taking a step back in terms of like removing everything that they had before and starting from like a clean slate. And I'm feeling like going forward, we will see more and more interesting ways of doing things. So from one perspective, I think we're heading the right direction by just like a lot of apps that used to be to look really hideous now look kind of acceptable. And I'm really looking forward at like once we reach that point where all the apps would look pretty much the same, and I think we're getting there, then we will start to see like some apps that get out of the lot with really cool navigation concepts or transitions, animations, all sorts of stuff that makes a user experience a lot better on iOS 7.
Yeah, I think it'll take 6 to 9 months, but then we'll start seeing apps that were conceived of after iOS 7 and were fully built with iOS 7 in mind. I think in most cases, developers rushing to ship by the time iOS 7 launched just didn't have time to do like a soup to nuts rewrite and rethink of how their interfaces should work. So they were kind of forced to just like color a nav bar and maybe change some fonts and call it an update. But like more around the time of iOS 8, I think things will start getting really interesting.
Yeah, I get that. There's just like little things like OmniFocus, right? OmniFocus is one of my favorite apps. I use it constantly. I've sent the Omni group so much goddamn money for that app. All the different versions. They totally redesigned their app for iOS 7, and it looks great, and it works great, and they took advantage of a lot of great stuff. But there's like little things like on their main screen. So if you haven't seen the new OmniFocus app, basically what it looks like is kind of the calendar week view up at the top on their home screen, the calendar week view, and then essentially like a grid of different ways to view different like inbox and your projects and your contexts. So the top of the screen has like a little calendar view that tells you the next 7 days, I have this many things due on this day, this many things due on this day, this many things due on this day. And then below that is like a grid of icons, kind of. And the interaction is that when you click those, the screen actually kind of splits in two, opens up, and you see the new screen, the list behind it. So when I click on the inbox, the screen opens up, and there's a list, a more traditional list view behind that of all the items in my inbox. And that works awesome. The problem that I have with it is that when you click on or when you tap on the forecast view, which is that top week view, the same thing happens. The entire screen opens up and you see the list view behind it, but the forecast view still has that same week view at the top of it. I just think they missed a huge opportunity to tap the forecast view and just have the bottom slide away and see the list there. Never lose the context of that forecast thing, right?
So on this forecast view, are the interactions with that view different depending on the context you're in, or is it exactly the same? Like can the second one do something that the original forecast view cannot?
The original forecast view is just static. So you can't, it's not like you can interact with it at all.
Okay.
It just shows you the next 7 days. So when you tap on it, then it brings you to the forecast view, and now you can interact with that thing. Now I can click on the specific days. It's the first thing I tried, and it's the first thing that I was like, wow, why didn't they, like, it feels like a missed, and that's kind of been my experience with iOS 7 this whole, for everything, is like, it all looks great, but it just all feels like it's missing by just a little bit. Like, there's nothing out there. There's not one app out there, I don't think, that I feel like totally nailed it.
Don't you think that's the case also for Apple's own apps? I think that still applies to the whole OS, actually.
Totally, yeah. But I've always said that, like, Apple's apps have never been the best-looking apps on the platform, ever. Not since iOS 2. Right, the second third-party apps came on the market, there have been better-looking apps than Apple's apps.
Do you still think that holds true in iOS 7?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all using more stock UI than ever. I mean, Remote came out this week.
Oh, and is it?
It looks nice, and it doesn't crash anymore, which is super great. But it's not super compelling. But I guess it doesn't have to be, right? Because the Remote, you shouldn't be looking at it. You just use it. You should be looking at your TV. Movie trailers is pretty good. Like, there's nothing crazy shocking about it. It's just really well done.
I guess my biggest gripe with iOS 7 right now is that out of the box, everything looks subdued. Like, everything is trying to not get your attention. So you're looking at very thin hairline icons with very thin separators between cells, almost inexistent, like, color. Well, actually, it's a white nav bar. And almost everything is just trying to disappear. And that's a problem in itself.
No, I, I, I think the problem there is that people, like, the intent behind that is that the Chrome shouldn't be fighting for your attention. The interactions with the Chrome and the, like, the things you can do and the content of the app should, are what should have your attention. So I totally understand having a subdued nav bar, right? Like, that's not something that, like, you shouldn't go, I get what they're trying to go for with, like, you shouldn't open an app and be like, oh, sweet nav bar, right? Like, that's not, you should open the app and be like, oh, this is cool, look at all the things I can do with this, or look at all the things in this, right? I just, again, I think that people haven't taken advantage of that as much as they could. Like, everything at this point feels like a text-based application. And I don't think it necessarily needs to be a text-based application. I think people can take more advantage of images and color now. I think they can take more advantage of that now than they were able to before.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally get that the idea of, like, Chrome needs actually to disappear. But there is still, we need some level of Chrome so that we tell the user, this is what you can do with this app. And, like, if everything in the app is subdued, like, not even buttons, there are no buttons anymore. It's just colored text. And the user actually have no idea what are the possible actions to take on that app. Like, a user who is not used to the OS, maybe in, like, 6 months, most users would get accustomed to that. But I really think that Apple went a little bit too far. They could have stopped at the point where remove borders from, so I'm talking about UI button, for instance. They could have stopped at the point of, like, remove shadows, remove insets, have one like color background, but at least have some sort of container to that button, because they went like a little bit to the extreme. Like, at least they need to have some sort of, like, visual clue beside color that would say that this element is tappable. That could be underline, although that's going to just take us back to 1995 with the, like, web stuff. But I guess there is not enough affordance in a lot of the UI controls in iOS 7. And that's fine. I mean, you can still create your own visuals. And I guess this is where third-party developers can shine, is fix sort of, like, the things that Apple overlooked when they were working on the, and maybe one, like, in iOS 8, Apple would start stealing those ideas, just like they stole Pull to Refresh and a bunch of other things.
I mean, that was someone on the day iOS 7, I think it was Craig Hockenberry, the day iOS 7 was released, just posted on Twitter, man, iOS 8 is going to look awesome. You know, it's just like, it's a transition step. And they took a big jump, and they took a bunch of risks, but it's going to take a little while for developers to get used to the new idioms and for Apple to get used to the new idioms, because, like, it's been talked about to death, but, like, you really kind of get the sense that this is, like, a six-month redesign, you know what I mean, yeah. Or less. Like, how long between the time between when Forstall left and WWDC, like, that's how much time they had to redesign the entire OS. And it shows in some places.
I'm still curious about that timeline. I kind of think that they probably started on iOS 7 design before, and that's what all the fighting was about. And then at some point, they just let him go. What do you think?
I don't know. It's such a 180. I can't see. Maybe it started as, like, a Skunkworks thing. Like, I could see it starting as, like, a Skunkworks kind of thing. Like, hey, let's just take a small team and rethink iOS and what could the lock... Like, start at the lock screen, right? Like, the lock screen constantly seems like the most... I was going to say it was the most thought-out design, but when it came out, it had, like, 16 arrows on it, and none of them told you which way to swipe to unlock.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, honestly, I still swipe in the wrong direction from time to time.
Yeah, I do, too. I don't know, but I could see it being, like, a Skunkworks thing, and then some parts of it catching on, and then being like, but I don't know. It's such a 180. It still feels like something that was, like, done after he left.
6 months is not a lot of time, though. Impressive.
Yeah, but I guess, like, things like TextKit and things like that. I guess they were underway way before.
Yeah, UI Dynamics must have been. There's no way, you know, UI Dynamics must have been underway before TextKit. View controller transition stuff, like all the underlying
right.
stuff.
Yeah,
it's just like the design itself.
The coat of paint.
Wrap this one up.
Yeah.
You want to shut this down.
So the show notes for this episode will be found at thoughtbot.com/buildphase/15. If you want to get in touch, you can send us an email, buildphase@thoughtbot.com, or get in touch with us on app.net or Twitter @buildphase. And if you're enjoying the show, we'd love it if you'd leave a comment or a rating on iTunes. It really helps us reach more listeners.
This episode of Build Phase was produced, edited, and recorded by Mike Manor.